As the coronavirus surges, a new culprit emerges: pandemic fatigue. Exhaustion and impatience are creating new risks as cases soar in parts of the world. They have had enough, one U.S. mayor said of her residents. The issue is particularly stark in the United States, which has more known cases and deaths than any other country, and has already weathered two major coronavirus surges. Infections spiked during the spring in the Northeast, and again this summer across the Sun Belt. But a similar phenomenon is setting off alarms across Europe, where researchers from the World Health Organization estimate that about half of the population is experiencing pandemic fatigue. The New York Times, November 11, 2020. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest this morning is Dr. Carl Meyer, a professor in the psychology department at Salisbury University, and we're talking about the effects of COVID-19 on stress and on our mental health. Dr. Meyer, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thanks, I'm happy to be here.
Carl, what have we learned recently about the effects of COVID-19 on stress and our mental health?
Well, over the spring and summer, we were seeing really much higher levels of mental health issues compared to last year. And that includes things like stress, depression, substance abuse, even suicidal thoughts. And this was far worse of an impact that we saw on young adults and communities of color and essential workers. And even though the stress levels seemed to level off by August, it looked like it was actually increasing in places where COVID was more active. So, you know, as of October, the latest data from the Stress in America survey by the American Psychological Association, that shows that almost 80% of Americans report significant stress related to the pandemic. And this is data from prior to the COVID surge that we're seeing right now. And I'll also note that's on top of other stressors that were there before. And just as an example, 3 in 5 people in that survey say that the number of issues that America faces is simply overwhelming to them. And young adults, as before, they're reporting a lot more stress compared to older adults. For example, 70% of them found it hard to concentrate or felt lonely. And in general, we're talking about 1 in 5 adults say their mental health is really worse than it was this time last year. And the proportion of people who say that they could have used more emotional support than they had gotten over the past 12 months was substantial. 61% for most adults, but again, young adults, 82% saying that they didn't have enough support. So the CEO of the American Psychological Association, Arthur Evans, has made it clear that we really need to take a more proactive approach to mental health. And mental health is not something about other people who have problems. It's about all of us, because we each have some degree of mental health, and we can think of it as a continuum. Some have better, some have poorer mental health. And it's really important to prevent problems before they start.
Well, Carl, let me ask you, as you go on, earlier you said that students feel that they're not getting enough support. What do you mean by support? And what would they be looking for in terms of support?
Well, those survey results weren't about students per se. They were young adults in general and adults in general. And that particular survey didn't necessarily get to what type of emotional support, but you can imagine in an era of COVID when we're isolating, we're not connecting with the people that we need like we need to. And so for young adults especially, this is so much of their formative years to kind of connect with their peers. And so that's probably part of it. But also keep in mind that everybody's kind of strained right now. So we may not be as available for other people to be emotionally supportive as we might need. So that would be my sense about what people need right now. In addition to the actual more traditional mental health services, there's clearly a demand. And I will say on that note, just make sure your listeners are aware that, you know, if they have concerns or need help, local health departments are a good place to start to find resources. And in the Salisbury area, dialing 211 and that first option takes you right to the Life Crisis Center. And they have all kinds of specialists there to respond to everything from suicide to family crisis. So, but, you know, in general, I think we need to prevent mental health issues. It's kind of like trying to treat heart disease in somebody who's had a heart attack. It's, you know, we can do things about it, but it's much better to prevent it from the start.
In the opening to our program, I talked about pandemic fatigue, and I'm hearing more and more about that on the news now and reading more about it, even though the part I read was back almost a month ago. But how would you characterize pandemic fatigue today?
I think that means something different to each of us. And I've used the metaphor before of, you know, not being in the same boat, as a lot of people say, but we're in the same ocean and in different boats. And people have, some are people are on sinking boats already, and that was before COVID. And, you know, they're faced with difficulties that are financial and emotional. And these people will be utterly exhausted as this goes on, if they're not already. And for some, however, the pandemic is more of an inconvenience, which can be fatiguing. But, you know, for others, their livelihoods and even their lives themselves are at stake. So when you think about you know, people needing to meet their basic food and shelter needs, or those people treating COVID patients every day. And if you think about it, you know, healthcare workers, we can think of them being in a boat too, or maybe a big ship as a hospital, let's say. And, you know, these people are down in the hull doing what they do best 24/7 for the rest of us. And we don't normally see what they do every day, unless one of them maybe comes up on deck for a news interview, let's say. But they have real limits. They're human. And as that ship starts taking on more and more water, they're going to get fatigued. And many of them are fatigued after 9 months. And at some point, adding to that, they're going to start seeing more people dying unnecessarily from COVID as well as non-COVID issues when there simply aren't the beds and the staff to take care of them. So that can be devastating for a community, for sure. But, you know, for everyday life, though, people are creatures of habit. And the quicker we adapt to a situation and, I think, establish a routine, the better. So if you think back since the early months, the science was pretty clear that COVID is likely to be a serious threat for quite some time, even a year or more, and have some ups and downs. And we know from psychology that one of the biggest factors in stress is our perception of control and our ability to predict what might happen. And so it's important that people are informed and realistic also about the long view of COVID. But, you know, as we know, that's not a popular reality. And so many people downplay this and outright deny it, including some leaders. And that really, that just puts people at risk of repeated trauma. If they're repeatedly told that it's going to just go away, yet again and again, it not only doesn't go away, but gets intensively worse as it is now. That clearly results in more stress for people, I think.
I'm certainly feeling the pandemic fatigue, but one of the aspects of the fatigue is that, isn't it, is that people begin to feel that they don't have to observe the cautions anymore. They begin not to take seriously the threat of this disease. Am I right about that? And if so, is that partly what we're experiencing today?
I think so, and it's perfectly understandable. This was kind of a new thing that happened for a lot of people starting in March, and it was a drastic response people had to make. And by April and over the summer, some of the data that I just saw shows that people's adherence to social distancing really dropped out quite a bit. And the weather was nice. People wanted to get out, but they were also going into other people's houses and enclosed spaces and not keeping that social distance as much. So people have a right to want to do that. And I think it's just normal to get sick and tired of it, to be honest, right? But I think it's important to note that most people do follow most guidelines. And you know, if we're talking about fatigue or just kind of resentment of guidelines, you know, I think those people who reject the recommendations really are a minority. And a recent Pew survey just reported that, you know, 7 in 10 people say it bothers them when people around them in public don't wear masks. So people do care, but, you know, I think there are a vocal minority that seem to not want to follow the guidelines.
I get the sense that represents also a kind of denial. And I know that we understand that some people just basically deny that pandemic is as lethal and as significant as the death of over 200 the caseload of over 200,000 cases a day now demonstrates.
Yeah, well, it really is. We've known for a long time in psychology that there's an overall tendency for people to think that risk somehow applies to others more than ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And we also tend to undervalue threats that are somehow distant in time. That, you know, well, you know, this is something that might happen to us sometime in the future. And also geographically, right? Early in the pandemic, you know, there were very low rates in the Midwest, let's say. And geographically, the risk was all in New York City, it seemed. And, you know, that really could have kind of affected how people viewed the virus. And of course, now it's quite the opposite, where the Midwest is being really inundated with cases. So that so-called optimistic bias, you know, it doesn't apply to me type thinking, is easy to fall prey to, I think, with this, because it is an invisible threat in some ways, right? But I think it's also that personal experience. So, you know, that same Pew survey I mentioned, 54% of Americans now say they know somebody who's been hospitalized or who has died from COVID. And that's up from only 15% in April. So this really does change the threat landscape for people, I think. But for some, the denial or the disbelief is more of a defining feature of who they are. And it's often probably mixed with concerns over, you know, being controlled by the government, being told what to do. And those types of views can, I think, quickly get into conspiracy theories and also kind of the tremendous power of social media these days.
In terms of the social media, what role does disinformation and misinformation play in the attitudes of people about the pandemic?
That's a great question. You know, COVID's caused by a virus, of course, but really the information is probably one of the most important determinants of, I think, where we've been with COVID and also where it goes. And social media is playing a very powerful role in that, I think. There seems to be a lack of factual information, first of all. At least that's being clearly communicated. And, you know, most people are just unsure, and that's understandable, and they want answers. But when there are questions and the answers aren't forthcoming in a clear kind of verifiable way, then conspiracy fills that need pretty easily. And with social media, that stuff spreads like wildfire. So I think of information kind of like a virus itself. It spreads and it's hard to get rid of once it's established, especially if it's not true. And so, you know, at first that those ideas can spread in limited circles, but when it becomes, you know, maybe part of the group that you identify with, whether it's a political party or some other social group or, you know, cultural identity, you know, you've kind of created a bubble and we breathe the same air and, you know, you kind of get the same news feeds and we're fed a diet of information. And that really greatly informs kind of how we think about these issues.
How do we break away psychologically, Carl, from that sense that, particularly in times of stress, I believe we all want to hear what we want to hear, and in the midst of all the information that is flying about, we pick and choose very often what it is that makes us the most comfortable or that enhances our sense of what we want to happen. What is the psychological role that plays?
Well, I think it's understandable that people, they do want to believe the things that are more comfortable to them. And what's comfortable to most people is what they already believe. And our beliefs are rooted in many different areas of our lives. So you can't just take beliefs about COVID and look at that separately. So, you know, people will kind of come to those beliefs for various reasons. And a lot of those reasons are our social groups around us and what our friends are saying. And we don't like to kind of deviate from that. It's a tendency that's, I think, largely human. Even though we have the capacity to look at data and information, people are, you know, likely to engage in what's called motivated reasoning and kind of, you know, confirmation bias, so it's called, where you seek out information that fits. And with media today, social media, online information, well, you can pick and choose whatever fits best, and it doesn't help. In fact, it's probably a huge part of the problem that, you know, we have these algorithms with a lot of big tech companies and social media that literally are feeding us a diet of information that is consistent with what we already look at. And so we create these kind of self-fulfilling bubbles, and it's very difficult to break that. And we're seeing that politically as well. And it's not just the virus, but politically, you know, let's say Republicans and Democrats, some research shows that on the internet, in terms of how people communicate on the internet, these people aren't talking to each other. They subscribe to their own viewpoints and they're not hearing what the others have to say. And that creates a dangerous situation, not just for democracy as we're seeing right now, but with COVID. We have camps of people who believe things and people who don't. And there are a lot of conspiracy theories now about the virus, the vaccine, and some people just don't know what to think. And it's very appealing when you have those gaps in knowledge and understanding that you go with something that has a simple kind of catchy solution to explaining things a little bit.
There is something, though, that is somewhat frightening to me, at any rate, about people who are admitted to the hospital, diagnosed with COVID-19, and tell their doctor that they can't have COVID-19 because it's a hoax, and it actually doesn't really exist. I hate to say it, but there is almost something pathological about this level of denial. Can you wrap that into some kind of psychological insight for us?
Yeah, I think we can think about this in, well, first of all, there may be cases like that, but there are also many anecdotes of people admitting on the hospital that they were wrong, right? And that personal experience is very powerful, but I suppose not everybody is persuaded by that. And I think it comes down to some of these basic concepts that we've been talking about, only a little more extreme, that people don't like to be wrong, first of all. And we like to keep our beliefs and for those beliefs to match what our actions are. So if somebody is that strongly in denial about COVID, chances are earlier, before they got sick, they were pretty vocal and outspoken against, you know, believing in COVID. And so that inconsistency is not a place they want to be. So they're going to stick to their guns. And, you know, we feel better when our beliefs stay consistent with our actions. So that's kind of one way to think about it. But, you know, that's a pretty extreme case you describe. And I think, you know, generally, if they still are denying it at that point, their beliefs, again, probably run pretty deep and wide along with other beliefs that are probably largely emotionally driven rather than evidence-based. And I think probably a lot of that gets into conspiracy theory and mistrust of the medical establishment and so on. And but the bottom line is inside, people really, you know, make sense to themselves, even if that doesn't stack up to reality.
Is it possible, or, and this is Carl, even probably the most difficult question of all, how does one break through that attitude? Or is it even possible to break through that kind of extreme attitude, or even an attitude toward truth and toward what is actually happening that is not that extreme?
Well, I think that's a terrific question. And I would say that some people simply aren't going to change their mind about things. And the best you can do is try to understand where they're coming from, try to listen to people and genuinely understand. And sometimes that will allow them to open up their mind. But by and large, people who are that set in their beliefs, you know, the focus really needs to be on the broader population. And that's where really clear, consistent, verifiable facts being communicated from the public health sphere is really important. And to help make sure that there aren't these gaps of knowledge and information. And for a lot of people, it's maybe not a gap in knowledge you know, a lack of information, but they are not sure what to believe. And so who is communicating that information is important too. And healthcare providers, you know, they serve a vital role in this. And so we know that, you know, trust in your healthcare provider is very important. But I think, you know, our ability to have conversations in society is going to be part of the solution to this. And those are, you know, person-to-person conversations, but there are also ways that we communicate as scientists, as public health experts. We need to make sure the information that's needed is out there to start with, at least.
Well, I think that's an incredibly important comment, Carl. But it doesn't help when disinformation is coming from those in authority, and particularly from our president as an example, and other members of the government who are in authority, who are feeding these concepts and that kind of disbelief in the seriousness of this pandemic that we're facing. We're looking at the development of the vaccine now, and the sense that we're going to be giving shots to people, or vaccinating frontline workers and essential personnel, maybe as soon as the next 2 weeks. What do you think that the availability of this vaccine is going to have on the seriousness with which the population generally takes the virus? That is to say, if the end is in sight, what is that going to do to community attitudes toward the virus?
Well, I think that's really going to be hard to pinpoint at this point. It's probably going to vary across people in terms of what the vaccine means. You know, some see it as a salvation of sorts and much needed relief. Yet others, maybe 40%, according to one survey, say they don't plan to get the vaccine. But in reality, it's only a tool. And, you know, along with other precautions, you know, the vaccine's only a tool until things are under more control otherwise. So I think there's understandable optimism that vaccines will bring things back to normal, but it'll take many months once that starts at a large scale. So I think it's pretty mixed about how people are viewing that vaccine. Some people might view it as, well, I can ease off a little bit on my, you know, how much I'm being careful because a vaccine will save the day, and it's just not accurate.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, though, is there are people who will not take the vaccine, as you mentioned, and as we hear from the media, and there seems to be out there a community of people who will not take vaccines generally. They won't have their children vaccinated against measles, for example. And I was wondering if you could comment on the psychology behind this kind of general attitude toward vaccination of any kind, much less this vaccination against this virus.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I'd first say that this is really not new. This has been an issue for all kinds of vaccines for a long time, but it probably is getting more intense right now. And with social media, again, we're seeing very disparate groups with you know, kind of different ideologies kind of coming together, linking socially over media with this common thread of, you know, anti-vaccine, anti-COVID control type of view. So you're kind of seeing, you know, for example, kind of the new age groups merging with, let's say, libertarian groups that, you know, otherwise might have very little in common, but they're finding this kind of common denominator. So there's kind of a synergy in some respects when it comes to COVID and the current vaccine. But in general, you know, people have to make their own informed decision. And that comes down to how people perceive any number of things. So, for example, how likely they are to get sick with the virus in the first place, or how serious it would be if they do. And if they don't think it's that serious, they're not as likely to get a vaccine. But also the risks of the vaccine itself. And, you know, when a vaccine is made in record time, people are, you know, understandably cautious. But people also have to, you know, weigh their perceptions of how effective the vaccine would be if they took it, and their trust about that information. And a lot of this comes down to risks and probabilities. And honestly, most people are fairly poor at assessing what risk is and understanding what risk means. So I think, again, this is where it comes down to the importance of trusting your healthcare providers. And, you know, in the past, seasonal flu vaccine, you know, if you are somebody who got that flu vaccine, you were much more likely to get, let's say, the novel H1N1 vaccine in 2009. And that seems very similar right now with intentions, at least, of the upcoming COVID vaccine, that people who have a history of getting vaccinated for flu virus are much more likely to say now that they intend to get that vaccine.
Carl, I want to thank you very much for a fascinating discussion this morning. This is Delmarva Today. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.